Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here, talking about birds today with you. Birds are they're so fun to watch. They're a wonder to watch and listen to. And, of course, this time of the year, we have so many birds undertaking their long migratory journeys. Others are getting ready to share a long, cold Wisconsin winter with you and me. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Carl Schwartz is the former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and is the editor of Badger Birder, the Society's monthly newsletter. He also serves on the Great Wisconsin Birdathon Committee of the Natural Resources Foundation and is the chair of the steering committee for Bird City, Wisconsin. And Carl, it's always a pleasure. Well, let's see if we got you on here. Well, let's try it. Carl, are you there?
Yes, I am, Larry. Good to be here.
Always a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for taking time to come by. Ryan Brady is a research scientist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Bureau of Wildlife Management. He's the bird monitoring coordinator for the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative, chairs the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology's Rare Birds Records Committee. And another one of our guests has been with us in the past, along with Carl. And Ryan, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, thanks a lot, Larry. Glad to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you both here. This is isn't it a fun time of the year, this fall migration?
Oh, I agree. It's you never know what you're going to see. Interesting things tend to turn up in the fall that you don't see other times of the year. Vagrants and migrants, and you get to look forward to some of the winter species that we'll get to enjoy too that we haven't seen all summer. Haven't seen for a whole year almost. So it's a great time.
Yeah, absolutely. Ryan, has the migration been unusual in any way for you?
Oh, I'm based out of Ashland, so I'm well up to the north here on the Lake Superior shore. And across northern Wisconsin, I would say it's been a fairly average migration year. There's been a few nuances. Some species maybe not as common as in past years. Harris's sparrow is one that comes to mind. But other species that are a little more abundant. It was a really good warbler migration in the north this year. And now we're just starting to kick off some of a lot of the water birds, so a lot of the ducks and the geese and the gulls and kind of the later season birds. And so it'll be interesting to see kind of how that pans out as we move forward in essentially the next month or so.
Yeah, absolutely. Carl, what about you? Seeing anything unusual?
Well, funny you should ask the timing of the show. I had a very unusual sighting in my yard. Not that it's accepted for regular American Birding Association counts, but I had a great tit show up in my backyard yesterday. It's a bird that's quite common in Europe, for over the last few years, a few of them have been seen in Wisconsin. Even some reports that they might actually have bred at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center here in just north of Milwaukee in Bayside, and I've seen a few of them, but to have one show up in my own yard, I was out looking at things passing through the yard and doing what birders call pishing, making little noises that might attract birds, and up in my binoculars, pops. I thought at first was a chickadee. It's a little bigger than our chickadee, but more brightly colored with some green and a big black stripe down its breast. That's quite an unusual yard bird and a real treat for me. But other people have seen some unusual things just the last couple of days. Some of these vagrant hummingbirds have started showing up in the state. I was looking on one of the listservs I monitor, and there's an Anna's hummingbird that just showed up over in Sauk County, and a female Rufus hummingbird down in the Fort Atkinson area. So it's that time of year when people, if they still have their hummingbird feeders out, should be paying special attention because most of the ruby-throated hummingbirds that we normally see here in Wisconsin, that's the only one that's regularly expected here, have migrated south already. And so, if you see a hummingbird this late at your feeder, you want to pay special attention to it. It might be something unusual.
Okay. Carl, the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, that was a real special interest of our late friend Noel Cutright and your
yes,
friends
indeed.
As well. It's one of the great achievements, I think, of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. When was the initial research done for that?
Well, the field work for that for the first breeding bird atlas was done between 1995 and 2000. The protocol for these atlases, which Noel was a guiding force for and the senior editor for the published atlas, is to do them every 20 years. So there's a group of people, Ryan Brady helping lead the way, that is working right now to get the spade work done to get the next atlas launched beginning in 2015. So, suddenly you look at the calendar and realize that's only a couple months away. So,
Ryan, you've been busy working on that.
Yes, this is a big project. It's the largest citizen science bird-related project, anyway, that we're going to have in the state. So it's kind of the ornithological project of the next decade, just as it was back during the first atlas. And as you can imagine, when you're sending out literally thousands of volunteers and surveyors across the entire state of Wisconsin over a five-year period, that's a pretty big project to plan. So we have a number of different partners working on that, from the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory to Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, Wisconsin DNR, and so forth, that are all kind of working together to kind of develop some sound science, some sound protocols for how we're going to do this and get the information we want, get the greatest bang for our buck. We have folks who specialize in communications who are going to help to recruit folks and get people on board. And it's just a really good team coming together that should all have a really great first year, I think, starting here, like Carl said, in not too many months when the next breeding season rolls around.
Yeah, and when will it be available eventually?
Well, the Atlas book, if we publish an actual book, which remains to be seen, some states only publish an electronic version, that would be a number of years out. You're probably looking at about, maybe 7 years out from now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
the
results would be available in the interim as we go through the entire process.
Just as you go along, the results are going to be made available. Very good.
Yeah, the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology is playing a role again in this. We talk about our three-legged stool here with the observatory and WSO and the DNR. Those are the major partners, but we'll have lots of other cooperating partners involved in this as well. The Fish and Wildlife Service will no doubt play a role in this, and literally thousands of volunteers from around the state to actually do the field census work to track which birds are breeding in the state and to document that. And very shortly, the WSO will be launching a new website, and the portal for the Breeding Bird Atlas will be on that website. So,
very cool.
People can look forward to that shortly.
We have. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I should mention and give a shout out to Nick Anich, who's one of Ryan's DNR colleagues, who's been named the DNR's director of the project. And he's doing a lot of the organizing work on this, and should also mention Bill Miller, who's the Noel's successor as director of the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory. And Bill is playing a big role in this, along with Mike Reese, who's the director of volunteers for the project. So a lot of different people involved in this.
We have callers online, by the way. You can join in with your own question or comment at 1-800-642-1234. We have an open line, get you on pretty quick. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question and photo, perhaps, on my Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page for that. Kevin wanted to mention that he's attending a loon symposium in Ashland, Wisconsin this weekend at Northland College. And there's a world-renowned, actually more than one, world-renowned loon experts are going to be there. And I imagine you guys were familiar with that or knew about it at least.
Larry, that's a conference that's actually taking place in my hometown, which doesn't happen too often, right in my backyard. And I believe that's coming up this weekend. And it's been quite a few years since this sort of gathering of loon experts has taken place in the region, and certainly within the northern tier of the state. So if folks have interest in loons, it's going to be applicable to, you know, everyone from hardcore scientists down to the, you know, maybe the lakeshore homeowner who just wants to learn more about the pair of loons on their lake that they see each summer. So put it on your calendar and make it if you can, and I think you'll leave very much pleased with your increased knowledge of why loons do what they do and how their populations are doing.
Lyman in McFarland has a question. Lyman, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I posed this question to one of your guests a year or two ago, but he was just a wildlife expert, not a birder. Anyway, about 3 or 4 years ago, we saw this very strange bird. This was in the early spring. There weren't any leaves yet on the cherry tree where we saw it. And we got my wife and I got a very good look at it. It was a fair-sized bird. Its feathers were gray, dark gray, and kind of matted. It almost looked like it had escaped from an oil spill. It was the size of a blue jay. It had a beak that looked like a blue jay. When it moved in between the branches, it looked like a blue jay. They have this way of hopping between branches without spreading their wings.
Yeah.
But instead of having a swept back, smooth top knot, it had like almost like a mohawk. So this bird basically looked like a blue jay dressed up for Halloween.
No.
I've just never seen anything like it. And I don't know whether it was a vagrant or some sort of a strange mutant or literally had gotten his feathers matted in some chemical.
Well,
boy,
what do you think, Carl?
I always commiserated with my late friend Noel after he had gotten a question like that on your show, Larry, because those are real stumpers. I mean, you know, it's really hard to, as you say, it could have been something that had gotten contaminated and changed its looks altogether. Blue jays have what they call structural color, and sometimes if the light's not right, they can look very gray. I couldn't rule that out. But really, if it had gotten oil or something on its feathers, it's really really hard to tell.
Yeah. Lyman, I'm afraid without a picture, a photo would have been.
Right.
Would have been helpful.
That's the saving grace anymore for a lot of the records committees, that so many more people have good digital equipment and are able to get a picture of that odd bird and share it and help with the identifying. So even cell phones cameras have gotten so good that if they're not too far away, people are able to get cell phones.
Yep. Absolutely. Thanks a lot for calling, Lyman. Appreciate it. Visiting today with Carl Schwartz and Ryan Brady about the fall bird migration. I'm Larry Mueller. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, though, we're talking about the joys of birding with Carl Schwartz and Ryan Brady. Thanks to them for coming by. And thank you so much for listening in. Appreciate it very much. And Mary Ann in St. Charles has a question, so let's go to her. Hi, Mary Ann.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's
good
on your mind?
Hi. Pardon me?
I just said, what's on your mind?
Oh, okay. I wanted to say a shout-out to the guys for coming on the air. There was two things. I also saw an unusual bird that I'd never seen before. It was like between 15 and 17 inches. Didn't get a picture because a lot of times they can even see you through the window, and it was just so kind of stunning. He was eyeing a nest that we had, which was, they tend to build the same nest over and over because our dryer vents up in this evergreen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a beautiful nest. But unfortunately, during the summer, twice we saw really big fledglings like on the sidewalk. Like, you know, I thought, well, I hate to say it, but they usually eat them. And then I was doing some research, and they said that sometimes scavengers will just throw them out of the nest and want the nest, or they're spiteful or something. So that's what we think happened, because they were really big. I think they were robins. But so this bird was sitting on our railing eyeing this nest, which I thought, how did he see it? Because it's really close to the house and it's in an evergreen bush. So I was wondering, it has the blue markings, but that doesn't make it a blue jay or an oriole, but it was so big, 15 to 17 inches. Do they have any idea what that would be? And also, how do you, I try not to see birds just because of, you know, attracting raccoons and skunks until like the ground is frozen, just figuring it's, you know, maybe a better habit for them to get into when there's nothing around. And how do you keep those out of there? Because I think we had a raccoon, because we'd fill it, and then the next morning it would be all gone. And the squirrels don't come out at night, I don't think. I think they hibernate at that time. So if you have any ideas, that's great.
Okay. Well, that bird, go ahead, guys.
Well, I'll try the second half of that first. I mean, you know, raccoons are the bane of my existence from time to time, and they are nighttime scavengers for the most part, and you need to find a baffle system that works to keep them off your feeders. Otherwise, you're gonna spend a lot of your money feeding raccoons instead of the birds you want. So. And you know, that's my only suggestion there. The other bird, if it was that large, I didn't hear any description from it, but probably a raptor of some sort. The birds that tend to hang around my backyard looking to have lunch on another bird are generally Cooper's hawks, which are
It almost could have looked like a hawk, but it was blue and white, you know, and it might have even been gray, but it was so stunning, and it wasn't there for that long. But, I thought blue jay oriole, but because of the blue, but it was much bigger than any of those that I've seen.
So a bright blue.
Yeah.
Not bright.
Yeah, I guess Cooper's hawk is a large, and especially the males can look rather blue and not gray.
Yeah.
So it could have been a Cooper's. The smaller relative is the sharp-shinned hawk, which looks very similar but is smaller, although you wouldn't have them in the southeast part of the state in any numbers during the breeding season, the nesting season. The only other choice, I think, is probably a blue jay, because they are, to some degree, they will eat eggs and even young chicks right out of nests.
Huh?
Okay, cause
so that's a possibility.
It's April, and this was like last week. That's why I'm wondering, is it a migratory bird coming through? And we did see a hawk in the next yard like a week before, but they look totally different. This was like light blue and more tropical, and it almost looked like somebody's parrot that escaped.
Oh, man. Well, here's the thing, Marianne. You got to get that smartphone out or your camera and get some pictures. That's what you need to do.
Good advice, Larry.
Oh, man. Well, but it's fun to kind of think of what it might have been, and you might just go to your birding book and take a look at what'd you say, Cooper's hawk?
Yeah, that's still my best guess. I mean, if it really was 15 to 17 inches. That's larger than a blue jay.
Yeah, well, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
There you go, Marianne. So take a look at a birding book and see if Cooper's hawk fits the bill, so to speak. Thanks a lot for calling. Jerry and Willard, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah, I have some quick observations. Yesterday, when I was sitting in my blind yesterday morning, I was surrounded all of a sudden by about 50 to 60 juncos. And he sat around on the ground feeding, and all of a sudden here comes somebody right about 10 feet off the ground and scares him away. It was a goshawk, scared him away. And then the other thing, they're talking about the blue jays. I was watching the blue jays pick up the corn and go and plant it and go around, poke and poke and poke and put it into the ground, then pick up tap on the ground, and afterwards take a leaf and put a leaf over the top of the hole where they had been pounding. I saw that four or five different times. And then a couple of times, a red-bellied woodpecker followed the blue jay up and poked in and picked out the food, and then once he even chased it away. And then the last one, a turkey with a fully feathered head.
Oh, that would be unusual.
Yeah. Your observation about the juncos is certainly timely. I've seen other reports that they've been showing up, but the first ones showed up in my yard just earlier this week. So definitely harbingers of the winter to come. One of the more common winter ground feeders around our bird feeders, particularly, but also out in the rural areas along roadsides, along with tree sparrows. And I've had a couple people tell me they've got tree sparrows down here already. And pine siskins appear to be the one winter finch. Ryan probably gets a foretaste of this up in Ashland quicker than most other people. But I've seen a number of posts about siskins back in the state.
Yeah, Ryan.
There are large numbers of pine siskins across the northern part of the state. Smaller numbers as you go all the way through the southern border, but that does appear to be the dominant winter finch right now. They literally up here in Ashland, they are almost everywhere. The kicker with that is that most people associate them with their feeder, coming to their feeders. But early in the season like this, they tend to hit the natural food sources more heavily. So they're going to be on things like birch seeds and alders, or maybe a tamarack or white pine cones, or I've even seen them on goldenrod heads. So they're eating those natural food sources until those become unavailable. And as we move on into the wintertime, the siskins will then start to shift maybe more towards the sunflower seed and the thistle or niger seed that we put out at our feeders. But we should definitely have those seeds ready because those siskins are coming. The winter finch forecast also projects that red poles will be around this winter. They have just started to show up in the north as well, and we would expect those to spread through the state in November and December. And they like similar foods that the siskins do. The other one that is around in real numbers right now in the north is purple finches.
Oh.
There are a lot of purple finches, a whole lot of them, and they are coming to feeders even now, although they do eat some of those same natural food sources as well as ashes and some others. But get ready for purple finches, too. All the other winter finches like pine grosbeaks and bohemian waxwings and the crossbills, those are all forecast to mostly stay in the boreal forest this year. We may see some small numbers, but it's not expected to be a real big year for them like we had, say, what was it, 2012, when we had large numbers.
And Jerry, of course, had some great fun watching those smart blue jays burying the food.
And the smarter red-bellied woodpeckers to come and steal it.
Right behind them.
We have purple finches here and also fox sparrows.
Oh, man.
So where's Jerry?
Willard.
Willard, okay. Yeah, wonderful.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate it. That's one of the real benefits of, I bet Jerry was hunting, he's hung up now, but that's one of the benefits of in a blind, you're sitting there for a long, long time, and you get to observe some pretty cool things.
Larry, birders should try that a little more often. Birders tend to be an active, run-around kind of personality, and we're always trying to go find the birds, but there's certainly a time where you can get some great benefits by just finding, maybe do some of that wandering, but when you find a spot that seems to be rather attractive, often that's maybe near a little water or a ravine or a stream corridor that's kind of shrubby, maybe with a fruit source, just kind of sit and set up shop, and you'd be amazed at how much will actually come to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Tim?
Ryan's observation is particularly timely because it comes right after or just about 10 days after the big sit. Events that were held the weekend of October 11th and 12th, and there were four of them this year in the state. One in Milwaukee, one up at the Forest Beach Migratory Preserve, one over at Horicon Marsh, and the other over in Richland Center. From looking at the postings on those, the one at Forest Beach had the most species. And again, a big sit requires people to stay in the same 17-foot circle for up to a full day and just count the birds that they can see or hear from that one spot. And as Ryan says, it's amazing what you can find just being in one place. And it helps if you have some good birders with good ears and good eyes and binoculars and stuff. But the group at Forest Beach had 70 species over the course of a day, it's always amazing what you can see just by sitting still.
A lot of fun to do that. Tim in River Falls, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Good morning. We do a lot of feeding here all season and like to watch the migratory birds, but we're also snowbirds, so this heavy-duty feeding we're doing suddenly stops instantly. Have we created a dependency and a population that's too great for the area? Where do they go to eat when we go away, and should we taper off like for the last 2 weeks to train them to go away?
I'll give Ryan first crack at that one.
Yeah, Ryan, go ahead.
Yeah, I think the expert opinion out that is somewhat mixed, though tilted more heavily towards no, you're not creating a dependency problem. The fact of the matter is those birds are often using that in a supplementary fashion this time of year, and are it's a less critical resource in many cases, not all cases, but in many cases, than it is, say, in the throes of winter and, you know, maybe February or something like that. So you should be okay. If you want to be on the safe side and you want to try the tapering off period over the course of a week or two, that sounds like a good plan, and that could maybe give you the peace of mind as you move forward.
Yep, there you go. Thanks, Tim. George in Mequon, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Well, we feed a lot of birds. We have everything from hummingbirds to cranes and heron and the like, and we like most of them. Right now I got a woodpecker I'm not too happy with. He's drilled a hole on the north side of the house and looks like he's going to nest. And we thought maybe he was just chasing some bugs. But what do I do? I was told by the fellow I called that's supposed to handle it that you have to get DNR approval.
All right. So are there ways short of dispatching the woodpecker, which requires a permit?
Yeah, that's what they told me. And he's inside because I was doing leaf cleanup yesterday and insulation is down in the yard below the hole, and that's when I discovered it. And it's like halfway up the second floor bedroom wall, so it's higher than I feel comfortable getting at myself. Yesterday said you have to go to the DNR, and then they have to catch it in a trap and take it away. Is that correct?
Ryan?
No. It's a pretty rare case where the DNR is going to come and dispatch of a woodpecker. Usually we would recommend some other measures before that, whether certain visual deterrents or sound deterrents, or maybe changing the aspects of the structure in which it's causing problems to. Because removing the bird is really just kind of going to be a Band-Aid. This is a fairly common practice among woodpeckers, and you're certainly not the first one to have a woodpecker that they'd like to get rid of. I would recommend, rather than going through them all, go on your computer at some point if you have that capability, and just go into your favorite search engine and go to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and it's birds.cornell.edu, and they have a whole page on how you can control or deter woodpeckers. So look there for some recommendations, things that you might be able to do first. Alternatively, you're certainly welcome to give your local DNR wildlife biologist or warden a call and see what they recommend.
Okay.
Normally, they take the suet and pack it in the trees, but this guy decided to come and live with me.
Yeah,
I was going to say, if it were more accessible, I live in the woods, and I've got the same issues with a couple of downies and hairies that regularly drill the wood shingles on the side of the house, and I just try and keep ahead of them by caulking the holes, or if I've got a if they get a head start on me by nailing a piece of tin across the hole to do that. If it's up at a height that you don't feel comfortable climbing, and I share that concern. You might just have to, there are people who do this for a living, and you might just have to call somebody. I don't think you have to dispatch the bird. I think you can probably just, you know, he can bang on the wall and it'll flee. And while it's out of the hole, you can put a sheet of tin or something over that hole and probably discourage him that way.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck, George. Thanks a lot for calling. And Susan in Menominee Falls, we turn to you next. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. I have a question regarding field guides. I have so many of them, and I have a little bird sanctuary outside my kitchen window, and so I'm always watching them while I'm doing dishes and such. But some of the books that I have only give you the pictures and the descriptions of the male and the female. Is there any other guides that give you pictures of, like, the young? Because sometimes they change so drastically from the young birds to the adult birds that I don't know, you know, how to identify some of these. And I'm just wondering if you have any good suggestions for a good field guide for this area.
Carl, how about it? What do you think?
Well, I'm a big fan of the Sibley guides, and there's a brand new one out. I don't own it yet, but I've seen it. I was out on the West Coast, and somebody out there had gotten a copy of it, and it covers. I mean, his drawings are really stunning, and the new guide has a lot more information and a lot more drawings and different age groups. I think it will end up being my new favorite guide. So it's a little big for toting around in your pocket, but it's really good and certainly would be a go-to guide for if you're trying to identify birds at home, particularly.
Okay. Now these are drawings, though they're not photographs.
Right, and drawings. I mean, you know, going back to Roger Torrey Peterson, who in my mind was the guy who perfected the science of illustrating the field marks on birds, how you tell birds apart by highlighting what's different about this bird from that bird, and I mean that's why I think drawings, particularly, are. I mean, all the guides that I've used and really enjoyed have had drawings rather than photos. And I was, Ryan, you may feel differently.
What do you think, Ryan?
Well, you know, I think it's really a personal taste of whether you like the drawings versus the photos. But if you want to be like a lot of other birders, just buy everything, and your bookshelves will be overflowing with every option you can think of. It's seriously, I mean, there's not a birder out there who doesn't have more bird books than they really need.
So figure out which
one you like, and you know, you're not going to find a field guide to like juvenile birds as they occur in the nest.
But you will find
that field guides now generally treat what's called a juvenile, or in some cases an immature plumage or an appearance, and in addition to the males and the females, when it is substantially different than the adult birds. So the Sibley one is certainly, you know, if you had to get just one, Sibley is where most people go right now. But look around and see which one works for you.
Mm-hmm. Good
okay.
luck.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. So he's got a new book. We'll have to get him on, get them on to talk about.
Yeah, it's really, I think, sometimes field guides change a little bit. This one is from my brief time with it, it looks like a real major upgrade. And it's just out because I looked for it in a place when I got back home and didn't find it, and I haven't looked lately, so.
Mike in Racine has a question for you guys. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, I have a question. I have a platform bird feeder, and I don't put out food routinely. So, in other words, the birds are not accustomed to me feeding them. So, but when I do put out in-the-shell peanuts, the blue jays will find the food within minutes. And I don't even see them flying around. I live in Grand Park, Texas.
Oh, well, you're breaking up. But that is, I was thinking about my father-in-law, Herb Stoudy, who puts out peanuts in the shell and is always amazed at how fast blue jays from out of nowhere, here they are. I don't know if you guys have had Ryan or Carl. Ryan, have you had that experience?
I do. I personally am always amazed with how birds find feeders, and I'm going to have to punt that one over to Carl because personally I have not heard of any really good input on exactly how birds are cueing into to these bird feeders. We do know now that birds have a little bit better sense of smell than what was previously thought. And so that could certainly be playing a role. It seems to me there are some visual cues involved also. But I think it's just another case of A, we don't know as much about the natural world as we should. And B, birds are just extraordinarily fascinating in terms of how they have evolved to make it through their everyday lives. So, Carl, I don't know if you have any more insights on that.
No, I would second everything Ryan said and our caller as well. It is amazing. I had quit feeding peanuts for a while and started feeding them again earlier this sometime late spring, and I hadn't seen blue jays around my feeders all winter long, all spring long, and all of a sudden, I'm not sure it was hours, but within a day or two, I had blue jays, and they've stayed around. And it's an incentive for me to keep the peanuts coming because I certainly enjoy watching them there. But as Ryan says, birds are absolutely amazing. There've been some studies on other species that are attracted to certain things. Black-back woodpeckers have been known to show up at fire sites. I mean, they tend to move into a forest area after there's been a fire that attracts certain insects into the decaying bark and stuff like that. And literally, very, very, very quickly. And there's been some. I saw one study that tracked birds that had some of them had been banded, black-backed woodpeckers. If they came into a fire up in northern Wisconsin, and these were birds that had come from 100 miles away in Minnesota. How do they suddenly know about this insect infestation in a forest fire area? I mean, I don't know. Do they come because of the fire, or do they come because of the insect, and who sends out a signal, or how do they pick that up? I don't know. But it is amazing, and that's one of the reasons I think those of us who are birders or bird watchers or ornithologists or avian fanciers of one sort or another are just infinitely attracted to birds. They just are amazing.
Yeah. They are indeed. Carl Schwartz, former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and the editor of Badger Birder, the Society's monthly newsletter, among other things. He's one of my guests. The other, Ryan Brady, research scientist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Bureau of Wildlife Management. They've been our guests in the past, and great to have them back to talk about birds and the fall migration. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk birds and birding with our two guests, Carl Schwartz and Ryan Brady. If you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234. If you've got some photos or questions that you can post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, certainly love to see that as well. And, of course, you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And our guests, Carl Schwartz and Ryan Brady, guys, I'm looking at my Facebook page now. I don't know if you're near a computer to get to the Facebook page, but there are some really cool pictures. Brian sent one. They're listening online and say, I love your show. Just for fun, here's a bird we saw in southeast Madagascar on Friday in the Breni Reserve. It's the Malagasy Paradise Flycatcher. What a beautiful...
I am on a computer, Larry, and I can see that picture, and I'm kind of salivating at how beautiful of a bird that is. If I saw that bird, I would be truly astounded. That is just fantastic.
Yeah, I hope people, as you listen, you might want to go on my Facebook page to the Larry Mueller Show and look at the posts to the show. And this, it has a long tail, kind of a white tail feather, but it's multicolored, just absolutely gorgeous.
It's Yeah, it's, again, one more reason why people are so infinitely fascinated about birds. There's so much, so much beauty out there.
And my good friend Jim LaLuzerne posted one from De Pere, another photo from a trail camera. It's a very large bird. I'm not sure what it is because it's in silhouette, but it's an absolutely beautiful picture. Ryan, can you figure out what it is from the shot?
Oh, that is a tough one. It is silhouetted against the sky. Yeah. It almost looks like it has some tail feathers missing. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on there.
It's a pretty cool photo.
I would guess either a crow or a raven is probably most likely. Alternatively, it could be some species of raptor, but it's a very difficult look.
Yeah, it is. I thought a raptor right away, but you may well be right. Anyway, it's a provocative photo nonetheless, and it's wonderful to have those photos up. We had an email from Todd in Delavan who said, is it possible I saw a gray hawk in Fond du Lac? Carl, is it possible?
Well, anything's possible. There are certainly rarities that do show up. That would certainly be well outside its normal range. I don't know if Ryan knows anything about that. I don't recall any such sightings in the state, but
No, we don't have. I don't believe we have any state records of gray hawk. It is not. It's a, I believe, a southwestern species.
Right.
Not known to really travel too far out of range, unlike some other species that have a propensity for doing that sort of thing. So most likely, it was probably one of our more common species. Which right now. I mean, gray hawks look a little bit like broad-winged hawks, although they are grayer, but most of our broad-winged hawks are gone now. They are very long-distance, what we call neotropical migrants, that are all the way down in Central America right now, so that's very unlikely. It could have been a northern harrier is another choice. It used to be called a marsh hawk. They are the grayest of the hawks, at least the adult males, are all gray, and that has earned them the nickname of the gray ghost. And so if you saw this bird kind of coursing low and maybe rocking back and forth over a field or a wetland or a ditch, then it was very likely a northern harrier.
Yeah, good. That's a good comment. Dennis in Eau Claire, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate your call.
Yeah, I have two questions, if I might.
Sure.
Yeah, the first one is we watch birds regularly, and we can identify almost everything we see. But what we can't find is a good book that tells where these birds nest, how high off the ground, what kind of trees, what kind of nest, leaves or a stick. I know blue jays and ravens, or crows, they kind of do sticks. But anyway, we've looked at our local libraries, we've looked at the bookstores, and I was wondering if you guys have a recommendation. That's one question. The second question pertains to the reference to the 17-foot circle that somebody brought up earlier as far as watching and listening and
yeah,
stuff like that. I'm curious as to who decided the circle had to be 17 feet as opposed to 23 feet.
You know what? That's a good question, Dennis.
And I'll take my answer off.
All right. Thank you.
I would say that the whole big sit idea was a construct of what is the magazine, Ryan? Birdwatcher's Digest. I think that's the magazine that originated this idea. This has been going on now for more than a decade, I think, and I have no idea why that exact size was picked. But it's basically to make enough room for at least a small group of people to congregate in it. Up at Forest Beach, the Bill Cowart hawk watching platform is conveniently just about that size, and that's what we only birds that are seen from that tower are included in the big sit count. Other people have marked out a circle roughly that size, but
Interesting.
I would say that there are There are some good bird guides out there. The one that I'm most familiar with is called the Peterson Field Guide to Eastern Bird Nests, and it's available on at Amazon. Where else? In paperback for $14. So
again, it's the Peterson Guide to
Eastern Bird's Nests.
Eastern Bird's Nests.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I just called it up on Amazon.com, and as I say, for $14.09, you can take one home. So, yeah, actually, there's some cheaper ones than that. Used, you can get them for less. So.
And someone else wanted to know, Brian on Facebook wanted to know, you were talking about the Sibley guy, the new one. What's the title? And Sibley's, I'm trying to remember how Sibley is spelled. Is it S-I-B-L-E-Y?
Yep. Let's see here. Sibley Guide to Birds. Let's see what the new one is. Yeah, I think this is the new one here. The Sibley Guide to Birds, second edition. Barnes & Noble is selling it for $23.89.
Okay.
And that's S-I-B-L-E-Y.
Yeah, that's
And again, you can Google that and find where to get it pretty easily.
Okay. Sally in Middleton, hi to you.
Well, thank you. I feel sorry for people that don't pay attention to birds because they are so amazing. My story is that I was closing up a cottage up north for the winter, and I took down my feeder, my sugar water feeder for birds. I have other feeders out in the backyard. And I just, putting them in the garage, locking things up. And here came this little, I rounded the corner after I had the first movement of mine toward the garage, rounded the corner, and here was this little hummingbird. It got into my face about 2 feet away, stood and hovered there, little wings going, and as though he was saying, "What are you doing with our food?" And can you imagine that? Instead of heading right in my face, stayed there, and I just felt terrible. And I thought, I should have just left it out there and dried it up normally, just so it could have seen what was going on. But
how do they know? I don't know. Carl, what do you think?
Well, that is interesting. My mother always told me, my mother got me interested in birds, and at 92, she's still a backyard bird watcher, and she had a hummingbird feeder right on a window in the house she used to live in, and when it got empty, the birds would literally come up and almost bang on the window to tell her it was empty. So, we talk about dependency, whether we feed birds for the birds' benefit or our own benefit, and as Ryan said, there's some differences of opinion about that. They do have birds do have lots of other things they can do for feeding besides our feeders, but they do get habituated to them.
Yeah.
And there's also what we call in birds sight fidelity. They get used to. I'm always amazed, and when you talk to banders, who have banded, there's a MAPS program, a MAPS banding program up at the River Edge Nature Center. It's been going on for more than a decade, and they would routinely have a recapture of a bird that they had banded in a previous year, that was one of these neotropical migrants, and that bird had been from here to. Costa Rica or Honduras or someplace, then back several times, and yet was coming back to the same mist net where it was caught. And some of our feeder birds are the same way. My mother swears that the same hummingbird was coming back each time, and so they do become dependent. And I guess that means leave your feeder out for a while.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Or don't take it in until you're sure the birds have quit using it, I guess.
Mike in Green Bay, hello to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. I want to know what kind of a birdhouse should I put up for owls in my backyard to take care of the rodent population.
Oh, okay. Well, Ryan?
Well, you have a few choices. I mean, it kind of depends on exactly where you're located and what kind of habitat you have right around your vicinity. There's
three main species of owls that will use nest boxes at some point in their life cycle, their annual cycle. One is the eastern screech owl. And the eastern screech owl is more of a southern species. It will often roost in these boxes by day, with a chance, too, that it would nest in there during the appropriate season. So you could try a box that fits a design for eastern screech owls. If you look for boxes that fit American kestrels, which are a diurnal bird of prey, a type of falcon, that would also work for a screech owl. Another one is a northern saw-whet owl. That's more of a northern species, a little bit smaller. You might get one of those to roost in there as well. Again, pretty similar size as to what a screech owl would use. And the third, you would need a little bit bigger box probably, is a barred owl. And they're a little bit harder to attract to nest boxes as regularly, but you could go try and search around for those as well. Now, all three of those species require some type of woodland around you. So you want to have make sure there's some sort of wooded cover. And the more extensive that cover is, the better. And just look out for squirrels, because squirrels will often take over those boxes. So you want to kind of baffle them and make them squirrel-proof when possible.
And you know what? We're going to be taking a break for a look at the news. But all those owls that you mentioned, and a few more, I've got the songs of those owls, which we thought would be kind of fun. Halloween's coming. So we'll be listening to the songs or the sounds of those owls and a few more right after we take a look at the news. You stay with us. Well, whether we know almost nothing about them or we've studied them our whole lives, birds are fascinating creatures. They add a lot to my enjoyment of our natural areas. I bet they do for you as well. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Net. As we talk about birds with two guests, Ryan Brady, research scientist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Bureau of Wildlife Management. He's the bird monitoring coordinator for the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative and chairperson of the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology's Rare Bird Records Committee. And Ryan, thanks again for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Carl Schwartz with us as well, former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, editor of Badger Birder, the society's monthly newsletter, also serves on the Great Wisconsin Birdathon Committee of the Natural Resources Foundation and chairs the steering committee for the Bird City Wisconsin program. And Carl, great to talk to you as well.
Great to be here. Very interesting set of questions from our listeners today.
Yeah, haven't we had some great ones? I'm going to invite more of those questions, as a matter of fact. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. If you have a question or a photo on my Facebook page, that'd be wonderful. We've already got some pretty nice ones there. Donna in Hartford had a comment. Donna, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good afternoon, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a quick aside, it was just a delightful honor to meet you and visit with you and Kathleen at the listener dinner last month.
Oh.
Thank you so much for that. And guests, you know, thank you for sharing this exciting and entertaining information. I just love these programs. My call is in response to a woman who called in probably about, I don't know, 50 minutes ago. I didn't have time to stay on the line at that point. She was concerned about her feeders being raided in the evenings by potentially our little masked bandits out there, the raccoons. Now, I live in the city of Hartford, and we thought, too, that a couple months ago already, oh, my gosh, what is eating our food? But we have a squirrel baffle on. Our bird feeder is just at shepherd hook height, you know, so it's about, 5 feet up. So yeah. Not too high. Okay, I came out at about 1 o'clock in the morning and greeted a wonderful doe who was inquisitively looking at and And considering the bird feeder, and then I knew that it certainly was not a raccoon who baffled the squirrel baffle, but indeed the deer who could just simply walk up and eat at chin height. So my suggestion to that lady is to take your bird feeders in at night. Which is what we have to do. It's a pain, but unless you really enjoy feeding the deer, that's just kind of something you have to do.
Oh, what a great story, Donna.
Either that or put the bird feeders up at about 8 feet, and then you're probably safe.
There you go. Oh, my goodness.
I'm not sure you'd be safe from the raccoons on that one. You know, if you put them up to, you know, even if you put them high, the raccoons will get there. But, yeah, that's a really good point, especially those of you in the central and northern part of the state where bears are such an issue. Everyone wrestles with kind of how you fight that. And as someone who feeds birds often myself, you know, it's bring the feeders in every night, put them back out in the morning, and hope they don't come during the day. And if they do start coming during the day over multiple periods, it's just a matter of bringing them in for an extended period of, you know, maybe 1 to 2 weeks until that bear moves on, or whatever critter it might be. So that's a good tip.
Yeah. Thanks, Donna. Yeah,
you're welcome.
I'm lucky. Yeah, I'm lucky in that I'm pretty tall, and I just... I've gotten some poles that are higher to keep them out of deer's way, because when I hung my feeders lower, I had the same issue with deer coming in and managing to tip them just enough to empty them out and sort of like a gumball feeder.
Donna, thanks again. I want to give Lawrence and Bayfield a chance to join in. Lawrence, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. Thank you. I've got primarily two types of questions. Do your guests both believe that the consensus of opinion is that the ivory-billed woodpecker is absolutely, irrevocably almost, extinct? And then up in Ryan's area there, in the adjacent Bayfield County, there was a time when in recent years, when the Kirtland warbler was sighted in the Moqua Barrens, the Jack Pine area, and I'm wondering if there's any breeding record from that area. And just at the very end, Ryan might be able to comment as to whether or not the northern Wisconsin area has had any recent occurrences of the Jeer falcon.
Hmm. I can.
Okay, great set of questions there.
I just interviewed one of the authors of Rare Birds of North America, and the ivory-billed woodpecker question came up there. Steve Hall addressed. So I'll be interested to hear what you guys think.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah,
well,
thanks.
I will. You know, with the caveat that I haven't followed the recent news on the ivory-billed woodpecker maybe as closely as others have, my impression is that all reasonable evidence points towards that bird being extinct. Now, you know, we can never say never, right? And we're never 100% certain, really, of anything. But there really is no reason to kind of cling to the hope, I don't think. At least that's my personal opinion, based on the evidence at hand. Now, may it happen at some point, yes, but I don't think that's the case. So, Carl, you want to chime in on the ivory bill? Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, well, you know, when there was that one reported sighting that Cornell and several of the other conservation organizations touted about a decade ago, I got my hopes up again. And but you know, science is supposed to be replicable, and nobody else has been able to make another sighting. And so, yeah, I think I'm in Ryan's camp. I'd love to be proved wrong. I'd like to be optimistic, but I'm not. I mean, I don't think that bird is still here. There, you know, there's some people think that there's a hidden forest in Cuba that bird watchers haven't gotten to, that there might be still one there, but I think even that hope has dimmed in recent years. So
there we go. And the other questions, let's see, I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, the other aspects of the questions, the Kirtland's warbler, so this is a federally endangered species with most of its ranges in Michigan, and it really prefers young stands of jack pine, so it's a very much a specialist. We have some of that jack pine here in Wisconsin too.
as do some of Michigan's other neighboring states. And in recent years, the Kirtland's warbler has begun to move into parts of Wisconsin in very small numbers, like 5, 10, 15 pairs of birds. Most of those birds are down in the central sands of Wisconsin, so down around the Adams County area. However, there have been multiple sightings of males in the northwest sand, so up here in Bayfield, Burnett, Washburn County, Douglas County, that general swath where we have some of this habitat. There have not been any confirmed nesting attempts here in the northwest part of the state. So I think that gets to his question directly. So yes, we have some wandering males that are out there patrolling in the right habitat, and maybe already a female has found one of those and we just haven't detected it yet. But at some point, probably, given the population is doing pretty well, there will be some nesting attempts in the Bayfield or Douglas County areas at some point. And then to his other question, the Jeer falcon. The Jeer falcon is an Arctic falcon. It's a bigger relative of the peregrine falcon. And deer falcons, even in the wintertime, tend to stay in Canada with only small numbers trickling down into the lower 48. We had one here in Ashland that came back for 3 or 4 winters, something like that, back when our ore dock was up. And it would you could see it sitting on the ore dock. It was this big 100-foot-high perch for it to look over as it saw pigeons and ducks to hunt. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we have not had any recent sightings of Jeer falcons within the Bayfield or Ashland County areas. With that said, there have been some Jeer falcons detected in other parts of the state, like Buena Vista Marsh and Door County in the last few years, just to name a few.
Mm-hmm. There we go. And I just want to go back to the ivory billed for just a minute. I happen to have a carving of an ivory-billed, full-size carving of an ivory-billed woodpecker done by Bob Googie, who's one of the great. I'm just really fortunate to have one of the great bird wood carvers ever, for that matter. And it's a beautiful bird, and it sure would be fun to have an actual find of a live one. It's fun.
Yeah, it sure would be.
Yeah.
Hey, Larry, if I can interject just one thing here. I've been noticing where some of our callers have been calling from, and I can't help but notice that a majority of our callers have come in from communities that the Bird City, Wisconsin Project has recognized for their commitment to avian conservation. Bayfield, Menominee Falls, Eau Claire, Green Bay, Racine, we all had callers from all those communities. I may have missed another one or two, but that's been my project for the last 5 years. But I could use this opportunity to break some news. Bird City has a new project director for the state.
Mm-hmm.
That we're going to announce on our website later this week. Dr. Brian Lenz has moved up here from Tulane University to take over as the state project director for Bird City, Wisconsin. And I've taken a seat on our steering committee to help continue to direct the program and help it reach out. There's now a Bird Town, Indiana program, and I'm working with some folks in Iowa and Minnesota as well, interested in setting up Bird City programs. So the program continues to grow. We're at 87 communities now, and have another application period that closes November 1st, and already have a couple more applications in for the future. So
yeah, it's wonderful.
It's been a great satisfaction, and we're seeing a lot of good conservation initiatives come out of those communities. So I don't think it's a coincidence that a lot of our callers happen to be from Bird City.
Right, and of course you can go online. And actually, I think if you type in Bird City, USA, Wisconsin, you're going to get a lot of information about the program itself.
Yep. Bird City, Wisconsin gets you all you need to know.
Yeah, and it really is a wonderful program. Well, before the break, our news break, we were talking about, I think Ryan was talking about owls. Somebody asked about owl nesting, and you mentioned, let's see, you mentioned a barred owl, a northern saw-whet. What was the other one?
Screech owl.
Oh, yeah, eastern screech owl. And it so happens, I tell you, you know, with Halloween on the way, owls seem to be associated with Halloween. So Judith thought, you know what, it'd be kind of fun if we had some owl songs. So let's listen there, and you guys tell our listeners what, or now as you listen to this.
That's a good. That's. Can I do that one, Ryan? That one. Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all? Would be the barred owl, and that's one that's always cool to hear in the woods. Usually around an area where there's some water. They tend to their preferred diet is. Ryan will correct me if I'm wrong here, but. I think they tend to like snakes and amphibians and stuff more than other owls do. So,
and here's one. All right,
that's the eastern screech owl.
You're exactly right, Ryan.
Yeah,
that's kind of like a little bit of a whinny, if you will, kind of a descending whinny that is somewhat haunting. I think that's pretty fitting. I can remember growing up in Pennsylvania and being out in the woods in the evening, and I didn't know what that sound was, but it chased me out of the woods because it was a little bit haunting, especially when you didn't know what it was, but a really, really cool bird and always treasure the chance to get to hear one.
And they are calling right now. I guess I will always be grateful to my wife for finding us a house to retire to that's right on a big ravine with a lot of woods and everything like that. I had three screech owls calling in the woods adjacent to the house last night, right about between 6:15 and 6:20. And I'm not enough of a scientist to know. You know exactly whether they'll repeatedly call on that night, and I know I have them here, through the summer. So I suspect they're breeding someplace in the woods. But I've never heard three of them at once, and you could tell by the different calls. And some I got both the whinny call and then what they call the tremolo call, three different birds from three different areas calling at one time. It was pretty spectacular. And as Ryan says on a cool October night, a little spooky.
And here is the northern saw-whet. We have first the fall vocalization, then followed by the winter vocalization. So let's listen. Pretty interesting to hear those differences depending on the season.
Yeah, the saw-whets make noises. They make a wide variety of noises. They can be hard to pin down because there's lots of variation on what you just heard. Cat-like meows, maybe little barks and mixed in, and then they have kind of the regular tooting. That's much more recognizable that you hear in late winter in through the later part of spring during the breeding season. That's a repeated whistle that's very loud and diagnostic. But some of those fall and winter ones are a little bit trickier. They're also the smallest owl that we have, and they can very easily go undetected. People would be amazed how common they are without us really knowing that they're there as they go about their business in the evenings while we're, you know, sleeping.
Judith Sears Poisson going to ban saw-whets in Stevens Point this weekend. So that'll be a fun activity for her for sure.
That's a field trip that Wisconsin Society for Ornithology has planned this weekend up at Linwood Springs at Stevens Point. And I know the River Edge Nature Center and the Friends of Cedarburg Bog are doing an owl prowl on Friday night up on Ozaukee County, and I, from being involved with those groups over the years, That event draws more participants than just about any other field trip that the Friends offered. Yeah.
Here's a duet from a couple of owls. Calling back and forth to each other. You guys have an idea on that one?
Yeah, I've been known on this very radio station to have impersonated that owl previously, which was a mistake I don't plan to make again. but that's a great horned owl.
Yep.
And the male and females will often talk back to each other. The male is a little bit deeper voice, believe it or not. So, which maybe isn't surprising that a male would have a little bit deeper voice if we kind of think about humans, if you will. But the point is you can actually, that's one of the few species you can tell the males and females apart when they're calling if you kind of pay close attention.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And one final scream we got here. All right. Did I trip you up this time, or have you got it, guys?
Well, it's one of two. If it's an owl from around here, it'd have to be long-eared, I would guess. The other thing that I've heard that's pretty blood-curdling is a barn owl.
You're right the second time.
Yeah, those aren't in Wisconsin for the most part.
No.
Pretty rare in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's why I thought I might trip you up on that one. But you got it, Carl.
Well, Larry, this is a good place to say that is one of the most misidentified bird calls we have in Wisconsin, because if you actually listen to a recently fledged great horned owl, which is our most common owl is a great horned, they make a screech that is very similar to that from about the time they leave the nest in maybe March or so, February or March, all the way in through the early part of fall, so even to about right now. And it's a begging call that these young great horned owls make. And it doesn't sound like a hooting. It sounds like a very harsh screech. So we very often get reports of barn owls that are heard when in reality they are these young great horned owls.
Yeah. So, well, I've exhausted my supply of owl sounds for you guys. And you did an excellent job of identifying every single one, which, frankly, I knew you would. I knew you would.
Yeah, but next time you could give us a heads up that we're going to be tested. So.
Well, you don't like pop quizzes.
Well,
I wouldn't let you. I wouldn't have let you suffer too long.
I know. You're a good guy.
Oh gosh,
it was a good quiz, Larry. It was a good quiz.
Well, I tell you what, you are. Speaking of good, you guys are good guys, and you're great birders. And I really appreciate you taking time to be with us. Hope we can do this again.
Well, I always enjoyed listening to Noel and Bill Volkert on your show, and it's an honor to have a chance to be on the show, and you know, on behalf of the birding community, our thanks to you for giving an opportunity to let birds have a voice on the radio.
Well, we certainly, and we're not going to quit. We're going to keep at it. Carl Schwartz, Ryan Brady, thank you so much. We are out of time here. I want to thank you so much, and I'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you for being with us today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just to let you know, tomorrow we're going to get some great consumer protection advice, including how to create the best password possible. So I hope you'll stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Keep listening.